when I was growing up, I had this children's picture Bible, and it was basically comics of the whole Bible. And we'd get it every Sunday after Sunday school. And then I found out you could just buy the Bible, so I didn't have to wait each week. So it was like, it's like binge watching a movie. It's like binge watching Korean serials. Anyways, so I bought this, and I went through the whole thing. And there's one image in the Bible which always kind of struck me as kind of spooky. And I couldn't find the exact same one, but this is similar. This is actually Rembrandt's one. But the one that I had in the picture Bible had this big finger writing on the wall. And the story is this one of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 5, where Belshazzar, the ruling, I suppose he's a king, sees this image of this hand writing these words on the wall. And I thought to myself, wow, this is the most spookiest story in the Bible. Like, what would this be like? And every time they paint it, is that it's kind of this glowing kind of words on the wall. And that's actually the passage that we're going to look at today. And I wanted to talk about, because I find that sometimes we look at these old stories in the Bibles, and some of us have been growing up in church for a long time. You might have heard these stories. And the question is, well, what does this mean for us now that we're older? What does this mean for us today? For a lot of others of us, we've never heard this story before. And it's hard to kind of read this and think, is this Bible real? This sounds crazy. So first of all, if you don't have a Bible and would like one, just raise your hand and our ushers will bring one by you. If you do have one, I invite, open it now to, or tap and scroll to Daniel chapter 5. And yes, I will be putting this whole passage up on the wall. And you're like, well, what's the point? Because as I go through it later, I want you to be able to just refer back to it a little bit. Right. So actually, I guess I should tell you, when they do Bible archaeology and history, one of the things is there are a whole bunch of archaeologists who think that the Bible is completely wrong. So they're trying to do everything they can to disprove it. Then the other flawed way to do it is you think that the Bible is exactly right, and you try to fit the archaeology to match it, which obviously isn't right either, right? You're supposed to kind of let the story tell. The cool thing is that as they've been doing history, you find bits and pieces. Obviously, history is not like science. You can test things over and over. You find artifacts here and there, and it puts together a story. Or you find something written a long time ago, and you think, wow, that matches. So there was a big controversy about this before, and a lot of people thought Daniel 5 is not true because Belshazzar never existed. We have no records of him, so he must not be true. He must not be real. And that's definitely coming from the skeptic side, which says, well, the Bible can't be true because we can't find any reference to this person. This whole thing must have been a made-up story. And a lot of people wish this was a made-up story because you don't want to hear about a magic finger writing stuff on the wall. It sounds too bizarre. What was kind of amazing was later they found this inscription, this Babylonian, is a kind of a, looks like a pot. It's not a full pot. It's like a broken piece. And in this, they talk about Belshazzar. And everyone's like, oh no, the Bible is corroborated. If you have a second source that kind of points to the same thing, you can date it back to around that time, it's like, that's like a perfect match. It's kind of a weird thing. So they're like, oh no. So they, as they went through history, they discovered, well, actually, this really lines up. This is part of the history of civilization. Again, which is really important for us to think about because it puts the Bible then, and it puts Daniel into a place in time in history. It's the kind of thing where when we're living through history now, as we're living in day and age at this point, we are part of history. The stuff that's happening to us now may be read about in the future, or if all those books are wiped up, someone, or all the, you know, hard drives are erased, someone comes along and they say, and they dig up artifacts, they'll say, wow, there used to be this person, there used to be this prime minister, there used to be these things that happened in this country. For us, it's starting to realize, wow, this Bible, this story that spans centuries is God's story for us, unfolded over time that lets us understand who he is and our relationship to him. So that, I always think it's like a whale spraying out spray. You guys, can you hear that? Every now and then, and I think, oh no, we're going to be, the aliens are coming. Right. So let's kind of have a look at this. Shall I read this out? King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. I'll just throw this out there. There's another kind of controversy because they're saying, wait a second, Nebuchadnezzar's direct son was not Belshazzar. So therefore, the Bible is wrong. Interesting, because there's two parts to this. In the original language, father can also kind of mean, and in the tradition, they also mean with ancestor or predecessor. But if you want to be a little bit more specific, Belshazzar's actual father was called Nabonidus, and who was probably married to one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, Nitocris, which is a great name for your children if you're thinking about naming them. And there's this idea that actually this kind of ancestor or father is saying, well, I'm still part of the lineage of the king, so it's okay to refer to him as a father. Now, Belshazzar himself was not the main kind of king over this whole place. Nabonidus was. And what happened was he said, look, I'm going to be taking all the troops and all the people to another part, and I'm going to put you in charge of Babylon. And so at this point, Belshazzar suddenly becomes co-regent, is what they call him. So now he's suddenly elevated to this position. And so there's this great feast that he decides to throw. Now, some Jewish scholars are trying to figure out, well, why did he throw this feast? Why is he having this big party? Is it kind of to show off how great he is or what awesome it is that he has this power? Well, a little bit more to that. If you guys remember when we looked at Jeremiah 29, and Jeremiah 29 says, God knows the plans I have for you. And it's the idea that God's going to come and deliver the people from exile in 70 years. Now, at this point, this letter has already been delivered to the people, probably. And so some of the Jewish scholars think, well, Belshazzar is saying, hey, 70 years have passed. The Jewish people are still enslaved by us. So let's throw a party to celebrate how their God is not real. Now, this is kind of speculation, and the speculation happens because actually Belshazzar got his dates wrong, and actually he was off by something like, I think still like 25 years or something like that, and he somehow calculated wrong, so he was celebrating completely the wrong sort of thing. So that's someone what some of the Jewish scholars think. But at any rate, what happens here that's significant is he says, hey, we're having this party, we have this really great wine, let's go and get some of the plunder that Nebuchadnezzar had, and we'll drink out of that. But it's not any other plunder. This is the stuff that is sacred to the Jewish people. It's taking the cups and the things that were in, you know, the tabernacle and saying, well, let's drink out of that. In other words, let's spit on their religion, on their belief, and let's spit on their God and say, well, their stuff is no use to anything. There's nothing special about their God. Let's just drink wine out of their stuff, of their these cups and these vessels. And so you see in verse 4, they drink wine and praise the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. In other words, they're having their own kind of celebration that their gods are bigger and better than the God of the Jewish people. And then it gets really kind of goosebumpy. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. I always imagine it's like a scene out of Scooby-Doo at this moment. And the hand writes on the wall, and then suddenly the king goes, oh, because that's pretty much it says. The king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. And it's the idea that he suddenly got really, really scared. You know what's that sense of you're doing something because you think that God's not real, and then as soon as you do it, something really scary happens, he was freaked out. He's like, okay, what is happening? Now, the words that are written, they think it's actually probably Aramaic, right? Many tekel, well, it'll come to it later. And the question is, well, why couldn't nobody read this? Actually, this was a language that a lot of them probably could have read. Well, I think when they say read it, it's trying to figure out what does it mean? What is it trying to say? What's the message behind this? And the king calls in all the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers, and all the wise men, and says, who can explain this to me? Daniel should be part of this group of people. If you remember, as we've been going through Daniel, Daniel is one of those. In fact, Daniel was the one in charge of these Chaldeans and astrologers and enchanters. He was the wisest man of them all under Nebuchadnezzar. But because Belshazzar was now in power, Daniel was kind of old and forgotten, probably moved along, signed his retirement papers. He is on just away. And the king, so worried about this, says, look, whoever does this and shows me interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom, right? Because number one is his dad, number two is him, and that would be number three. It's funny because actually Belshazzar is not as great as he thinks he is, right? He's not number one in the kingdom. He kind of just got this co-regency. And yet here he is trying to make someone number three in the kingdom. Kind of an interesting sort of picture that's being painted. So no one can read this thing, and we go on in verse 10. I skipped verse 9 on that one. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Now this queen, they don't think that's actually Belshazzar's wife. They actually think it's like the queen mother, the queen before him. So Nebuchadnezzar's wife, actually not even just his grandmother. Not his mother, but his grandmother. So I actually think this is actually probably one of Nebuchadnezzar's probably many wives, who, if you notice, was not at this party. She comes in kind of later into the banqueting hall, right? In other words, she hears this flurry of activity and says, what's wrong? And you get the kind of sense like this queen or the grandmother would be like, this is not a party I want to attend. This is my grandson being kind of ridiculous in his kind of arrogance in doing this thing. And then she hears this news and says, well, there's a guy who I know from before, Daniel, who has this wisdom. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king answered and said to Daniel, You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold round your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. First of all, interesting that Belshazzar has never heard of Daniel in his life, right? You would think if he was paying more attention in class or what his father was doing in his life, he would have known that there was this guy, but he doesn't. And when he addresses him, he just said, look, hey, I heard about you. I hear you got this thing. If you answer these questions or if you solve this or tell me what this means, I'll make you third in command. And what Daniel's response is, it's pretty classic. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Now, this is significant because Daniel puts away any sort of courtyard courtesies. He should say, O most high king, or O great king of Babylon. He does none of it. He just basically says, I don't want your stupid gifts. You can keep it for yourself. And it's weird because you think, well, actually, Daniel, why doesn't he why isn't he more proper? There's almost a sense that Daniel kind of knows, like, this king doesn't have his head on right. Things aren't right here. And so you see what happens next. Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. So Daniel begins by telling Belshazzar all about his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. And this is actually recorded in Daniel chapter 4, some of it. And he starts talking about Nebuchadnezzar and saying, actually, God's the one who gave him all the glory and the power. God's the one who made him king over this part. Because at that point, they knew Nebuchadnezzar had brought Babylon to its highest point. Since then, it was slowly on the decline. And the Persians were on the rise. And actually, one of the reasons Nabonidus had to go away was because there were threats coming from another direction. There are other people who actually thought that Babylon was pretty much finished. There wasn't that much more time left for them because it was slowly coming down and slowly falling apart, and its influence in the world was slowly dropping. So Daniel starts talking about Nebuchadnezzar and saying, look, God gave him this power, and God gave him this authority. And actually, that's why Nebuchadnezzar was able to get that high. And then verse 20 says, but when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar's pride got in the way. In other words, when Nebuchadnezzar started thinking he was greater than God. Verse 21 says, he was driven from among the children of mankind. His mind was made of like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are your all your ways, you have not honored. So Daniel just lays it into him. He says, you actually know what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He got proud and God cursed him, and he ended up living like an animal for years until finally he sort of sees the light. And God touches him and he comes back. And which means Belshazzar should be aware of what happened to his grandfather, of these stories. And so when Daniel says, look, you knew all this, and yet this is how you treat even the God that your grandfather, who's not a believer, understood and respected. You've gone and taken these things from, you know, these sacred objects, and you just drink out of them with your little party. And then we get to what's writing on the wall. Oh, did I not click that last one? Sorry. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, mene, tekel, and parson. Which means, actually, numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided. And this is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And Parson or Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now there's two things I want to notice about this. Actually, God could have just said, Mene, Tekel, Parson. Numbered, weighed, divided. But actually by saying mene, mene, it actually means that God gave Belshazzar many chances. In other words, God has numbered the days of your kingdom. In other words, he's waiting before he brings that judgment. He's numbering the days of how long it is. It says mene, mene. In other words, I numbered your days, and then I gave you some more days. I gave you a second chance. But Tekel, when I finally come to judge and I weighed you, I found that actually you're corrupt. And that's why this will be taken away from you. The Persians and the Medes are going to come. Now you would think like, if you heard this and you were the king, what would your first reaction be? It would probably be, oh my gosh, I am so sorry. I've really made a mess of this. But let's see what Belshazzar does. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. In other words, he just says, like, okay, thanks for the interpretation. Like I said before, in my power and wisdom and authority, I will make you third ruler of this kingdom, which will be taken away from me according to this prophecy that was just written on the wall. He is at a point where almost his pride and his arrogance is so far above God's grace anymore. You know what that's like, right? When you see someone who's doing the wrong thing and you tell them, hey, that's not the right way to go. And they're like, well, whatever. I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. And this is what's happening here. Oh, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old, which is pretty crazy, because actually, when they look through the history, that's probably around the time he gets killed, and then the Medes and the Persians begin taking over. And we're going to look at two primary things. The first is actually pride. Now, I know when you're in a church and the pastor starts talking about pride, everyone you meet says, well, I'm not prideful. I don't think I'm that special. I don't think I'm that good. Like, so I know I'm not a prideful person. And I think for a lot of us, when we think about pride, we think of, well, arrogance. You think of those people in your workplace who think they're all that and act really cool and try to kiss up to the boss all the time. And you think those are the really proud people who never take the advice that I, as the smart Chinese person in the workplace, am telling them softly in my quiet voice at my desk 20 feet from them. I don't know why they're not listening to the wisdom that I have. I'm going to kind of break down pride into three kind of categories. This is kind of like to test to see, you know, how prideful you are. And the first is actually you're kind of prideful if you ignore wisdom, when you ignore other people's wisdom. And you kind of know this is the case when anytime someone says something, you say like, that's kind of dumb. That's not a great idea. But I want to push it a little bit further in thinking about actually generations. Now, the wisdom that's shown to Belshazzar was actually if he had seen his father, his grandfather's life, if he had looked at that example and learned from it. But he didn't, right? He ignored all of that wisdom in that life. Now, when I read that, I was instantly convicted as a father and as a son. You begin to think, well, actually, what is the story that I'm telling to my children? What is the life that I'm living and demonstrating them? And this is for fathers, for mothers, for grandfathers, for grandmothers. The question is, actually, is my life demonstrating the wisdom of God to my children? Because it's one thing for you to expect your children to see that, but it's another thing for us to live that, to represent that life, to demonstrate that outward. It begins to convict you because you start seeing and realizing, well, your kids pick up stuff from you, and are they picking up wisdom or are they picking up foolishness? I was kind of annoyed with my son Alex the other day because he said, okay, yeah. He said that a lot. And I was like, Alex, just think what you're going to say and say it out instead of just saying that phrase all the time. And then 2 seconds later, I was talking to him and I realized I was half speaking to him because I stopped and went, yeah. And then I continued my sentence because what I was doing and the reason I say, yeah, all the time because I'm not actually paying attention to him, so I'm trying to do something else while speaking to him. So I'll say my sentence, then say, yeah, to get my brain catch up with the rest of my sentence. And Alex had picked up, yeah, or okay, from me. And he was doing it not because he wasn't paying attention to me, was just because he's trying to figure out what to say. And I was convicted. I was like, oh my goodness, this is my habit that he's learned. What kind of life am I demonstrating? So one of the things instead that I've tried to do more recently is when we do manage to sit down together and eat, I will talk about what I've read or seen in the news or have been thinking about. And it started off, I think the first time I did it was a bit of a rant about free school dinners for kids up to year two. And it was a bit of like, how's the government going to pay for this? Where shouldn't this money be spent something else? And there's a bit of a rant. And I was talking to my son all about, governments. And then I was talking about how there was no democratic vote in this process. And then it's moved on to, it's a horrible thing to live in my house. And then it moved on to Hong Kong and what democracy was. And I spent a long time, and then it was kind of fun because he was asking questions. He was trying to figure out, what are the things that I've read? What's the kind of thing that I think about? And the next day, he asked me, tell me what you've read today. Tell me some interesting things that you've read today. And I was like, so they built this fusion reactor, or at least the prototype of it. And I was trying to explain to him fusion and nuclear power. And then he was like, what else did you read? And I was like, okay, well, we'll go on. But it was one of those things where you start realizing there are opportunities to be engaging in demonstrating and showing wisdom to your children, which is important. Which is important because we can so easily brush them off or engage with them from a distance. And then wonder years from now, like, why don't they speak to us? Why don't they listen to us? Why aren't they wiser? The flip side, though, is for us as children, as sons and daughters. How do we learn from our parents? Now, in hindsight, for a lot of us, we look at our parents, and it's hit or miss. Some of us look at our parents and say, they are amazing, we love them. And others are like, I try not to think about my parents too much because I will just cry and weep because it's just too painful. There's actually this thing where you have the opportunity to learn from them, from their mistakes, from the things they've done right, from the way they've lived their life. And it's something that I'm struggling to try to do too. And I've come to this point where I really admire and love my parents. At the same time, it's trying to not sugarcoat it, but look at the whole history and say, actually, there are a lot of things I can learn. To be proud means that you throw away that knowledge. And it doesn't mean that you think you're better than them, but pride just means, like, I don't even want to think about it. I don't need that help. It's too much effort to think about that. So I just leave it aside. Humility says, wow, there's something I can learn in all of these situations. There's something I can learn and share to generations to come in my successes or in my failures. And one of the things I'm trying to do more is to be more honest with my children about when I failed, when I've shouted because I'm tired, as opposed to shouted because they're in trouble. And learning to apologize and say, look, that there are successes and failures in my own life as well. In verse 22, right, it says, and you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. For us, it's this thing like, actually, our hearts humble to learn from all the situations that we're in. And when you expand that out of just your family relationships into your workplaces, the times when you do well and the times when you fail, all of those are opportunities to learn and to grow. The second thing that we know helps identify pride is when you are looking to draw attention and glory for yourself, when it's kind of about drawing attention to yourself. Now, I know a lot of you might think like, oh, okay, well, I'm sure none of you are judging each other or judging yourselves, but there's kind of two ways, and I'll be kind of third person in this. There's two ways that generally people think about pride. And the first way they think about it is like the person who wears the flashiest clothes or gets the flashiest equipment or drives the flashiest cars because they're trying to draw attention to themselves that way. Well, the flip side is the person who, not anymore about drawing attention that way, but the person that's always complaining or always trying to moan or trying to draw sympathy for themselves, and they think how sad they are, what a difficult life they have, which is also drawing attention to yourself. Now, you think, well, how is that pride? How is that pride? Pride is the process of thinking of yourself more than anything else. Now, the first one is you dress like that and you are flash because you want people to like you. And it stems from an insecurity, essentially, right? You want people to notice you. You want people to say, wow, that's really great. Oh, you're really amazing. I really like you for that. the other side is, oh, I feel so sorry for you. Oh, I wish I could help. It's the same kind of thing. It's attention. It's that kind of support that you want. On one side, it's support for your insecurities. On the other side, it's support for your insecurities. Belshazzar is probably very similar in the same way. He throws a massive party for everyone in the kingdom. And then he says, well, even more than that, I'm going to take these things that my grandfather got, and we're going to drink out of them. That'll show them all. But that you see how weak his stance is as soon as that writing on the wall appears. He freaks out. And you realize, actually, this whole time he's just been thinking about himself, and he cannot break out of that cycle. For us, when we start saying, well, actually, what are the reasons that I'm living the way I am? It actually means sometimes facing those insecurities and admitting, actually, the reason I do this is because I do need the attention. And honestly saying, actually, it's because I want that attention. Because once you understand that that's the issue, then their next question becomes, why do I need so much attention? What is going on in my heart or in my mind that makes it just that I need to have that attention? It brings you into humility, actually. Because you stop trying to get it, but you start saying, actually, what's going on in my life? And then you begin to engage with God and say, God, actually, I need you to give me the attention that I really need. Because I'm never going to be satisfied in the other ways. And thirdly, and this is probably the biggest point of actually pride. Pride is actually thinking of yourself above God. And on one hand, that is thinking of yourself as better than God, which I'm sure none of us do, because we'll all just say, of course we're not better than God. He created the universe. He could strike me down. But thinking about yourself above God sometimes just means in terms of your priorities in your life. When your time is more important than time with God. Your money, your career, your dreams, your fears, all those things you place above God. Actually, this kind of pride gets closely tied in with faith, with how much you believe God is greater than these things, or how much you can actually trust him in this. In verse 23, right, it says to Belshazzar, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. Believe it or not, a lot of us, we lift ourselves up against God. Anytime when we start talking about how, like, well, it's okay, you don't have to pray for me, I can just deal with it myself. That kind of self-sufficiency, that's essentially saying, I don't need God. Anytime you have a lot of fear, actually, to face a situation, and that fear paralyzes or stops you from moving forward, that's you saying, well, I don't really have enough faith that God can help me in this. You see, actually, in our daily lives, over and over and over again, we deny Christ. We don't have faith in him. We put ourselves above him. We put our own needs above him. And that leads us to so much frustration and futility and fatigue, and we find ourselves just lost because we feel like we don't know what we're doing or where we're going. God's saying, that's what it means to trust me, is to say, I don't have anything except for you, God. Humility. Humility is actually knowing your place before God. When you know your place before God, it's this. You realize God is the amazing creator of all the universe, and you are a speck in the entire scope of everything, who is minuscule and should probably be meaningless. And yet, in that reality, God's reality is his amazing love for you, to call you a child of God, to say that he loves you and welcomes you into his family. That as broken and as messed up and as confused and lost as you are, God loves you extraordinarily. When you begin to understand the gap between you and God,
how you'll never be good enough for him, how you're not holy at all. But then you realize Jesus' love and how his death pays for you and means that you are now part of his family. That is humbling. That's when you just stop and say, God, actually, wow, I totally don't deserve you. And then that's when God says, nope, you don't, but I love you. One of the biggest breakthrough moments for me was that moment when you realize, actually, one, that God is infinite. And for me, this happened later. Because when I was growing up, you grew up in church, you're not afraid of death. You don't think it's a big deal. You just think, well, when I die, I'll go to heaven. So I'm not afraid. And it took me a little bit longer when I got a little bit older and I started being kind of afraid of dying. And that moment when you realize, actually, if I die, what actually happens to my soul? Does it just disappear? What does it mean to be saved by God? When you begin to understand that, you begin to realize, wow, there is a significant difference between my reality and the infinite God. But the second part is when you stop and you realize, well, actually, God, I need you. God, I need you above all else. That's when you realize his love saves. See, I think for us, when you realize humility is actually a place where there's no room to be stubborn when you're humble. There's no room to be arrogant when you're humble. There's no place for selfishness when you're humble. You know, when you're humble, it's like, well, actually, I can give. I can give freely. Because God provides for me. When you're humble, you're not proud or arrogant because you realize, well, God is above me, and God's given me everything I am here, and so I can freely give. When you're humble, you can't be stubborn and fight your corner just to fight it. You actually realize, well, actually, God's grace means that I can freely love. The more I thought about this, the more I realized actually there's a lot of small things that stop us each day. We are too stubborn to ask for help. We're stubborn to ask for prayer, actually. For a lot of us, there are things going on in our life that we're too scared to ask people to pray for. But we really need to. But we just think, well, everyone else in church seems really strong, so I'll just suck it up and get through it. But actually, maybe you need to ask for help. Maybe you need to ask for prayer. We're too stubborn to confess our sins. We're afraid of what people might say and what they might judge against us. We're afraid to talk about the struggles that we have. We're too proud to ask for help. We're too proud to admit mistakes. And this is one of the hardest things if you're in any sort of communication with people whenever you have an argument. No one wants to say that they were wrong. Everyone wants to give a reason for why they did it. But no one ever wants to say, I was wrong, and my reason was stupid. Doesn't make any sense, even if it's my own valid one. I'm wrong. We don't want to say that. We want to justify our position all the time. We want to justify ourselves. But when we stop before God and you realize, actually, in the scope of life, this is not an issue at all. And it's not about giving in. It's about giving up to God. And we are sometimes too selfish to give our time. And too selfish to share our finances. Because we say it's ours, it's mine, it's my money. I worked hard for this. I worked hard for my dream in life. These are the things that I want. And sometimes it's just a matter of saying, God, well, actually, God, what do you want? I think the last thing is it's sometimes we're just too proud to turn to God and say, you know what, God? I give up. I give up fighting you. I give up trying to just make a name for myself or just live for myself. But God, I need you. I'm tired of trying to chase for a life partner, or I'm trying to stop chasing for the perfect job, or I'm tired of chasing for a promotion. I give up by saying, actually, God, I need you. And I trust that in you, you are all that I need to. That is a hard thing to believe. And yet our God has always been faithful. And even if our life on this earth is painful and suffering, it is a short snippet compared to an eternity with him. Let's just bow our heads for a moment. Lord, we need you. We need you above all else. And yet it's so ironic because as much as we need you, we reject you over and over and over again. And maybe it's because we are taught to grow up to fight for ourselves, defend for ourselves, or survival of the fittest, or the early bird gets the worm, or any of those kind of things. When actually you are the strongest, you are the wisest above all, and we need to turn to you. And you do this amazing thing where you work with us, you work through us, and you show us, and you guide us, and you challenge us, and you give us opportunities to grow, and at those ends of those times of growing, we stop and say, God, you are amazing. So Lord, I pray that you break down our walls of pride where we begin to elevate ourselves above you. Instead, that we stop and we surrender and say, God, we need you. We look to you, Lord Jesus.